Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Culloden.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Culloden and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. And coming up on today's show, are global markets ignoring Trump's tariffs and simply doing their own thing? Why does Ireland have a sovereign wealth fund and what does it actually do? Plus the authors of a new book on the rise and fall of the global CEO. You can email the show takingstock@newstalk.com and I thoroughly enjoy every single message that you send in and we read them all personally, so please do keep them coming. Of course, you can also message me on LinkedIn, Instagram, X and Blue Sky at Susan Hayes Culloden. Now, I'm just back from the US as I go to Ohio every year and I want to start off today's show by explaining what it means when people talk about a strong euro, as I spent so much of the last few days talking about myself, or indeed any strong currency. Basically, it means that a euro can buy more of a currency than it could from a previous benchmark. So my euros were able to go further in the US last week than they did when I visited last year. So I got great value for money, of course, when I was going to my consignment stores in Hartville or out for dinner in Cuyahoga Falls. However, a strong euro is a problem for Irish exporters as it means they get fewer euros for the dollars they generate or else Irish goods get more expensive. So when you hear the term strong or weak, when it comes to currencies, you now know whether it's good or not for your pocket. Well, it's another day, another tariff deadline missed, extended or solved with a magic letter. Welcome to international trade under President Trump. While his initial Liberation Day announcement was met with panic on the markets, subsequent deals have caused very little ripple effect in the stock market. So I'm delighted to be joined by Kate English, Chief Economist at Deloitte. Kate, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thank you, Susan.
Okay, we'll start off by looking at the stock market, please, Kate, because it's acting like Liberation Day tariffs have gone away, but without the deals or the frameworks being agreed. The effective rate of tariffs on US imports will rise from 15.5% to 17.3%, he said. Now, at the end of 2024, it was at 2.5%. So this is a cost being borne by either US consumers or companies selling into the US. Is all this being missed?
Yeah, so as you rightly said, this is still a seismic shift in global trade policies. And there still is that downward revision there to economic growth across almost all economies. And if we take a step back, post April 2nd, what did we see? We saw a large reaction in the stock markets. At times, for example, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ was down over 12, 15%. So really, really sharp reaction to it. But since that, we have seen a recovery, and that recovery began to grow legs even a little bit more post the deal between US and China. Mm-hmm. And if I give you even just one index of all, if we look at the VIX index. So the VIX index is a volatility reading almost for your stock market. It typically sits at a kind of has an average value of 20. Mm. Where does it sit as of today?
16.
Just below 16, 15.9, which is phenomenal. The Monday after April 2nd, that hit 60. So what does that tell you? That tells you markets see limited volatility in the stock market over the coming 3 months, which is quite phenomenal in the environment that we are in. I think there's a part of this, though, that we also need to look at and say, well, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, they have recovered as people assume or markets assume that this will all work out. Trade deals would be found. We saw a trade deal on paper by the US and China. The 9th of July deadline between the EU and the US was postponed, but talks are progressing. We will get there. But to contradict itself, we saw a little bit more movement, for example, even only in the last 24 hours or 48 hours with markets such as coffee or also copper prices. And this is where we saw again, it was an announcement of a threat of an increase in tariffs on the price of copper, increasing them to 50%. Yeah. And similarly for Brazil, increasing tariffs from Brazil to 50% as well. And they were previously, as of April 2nd, meant to be at 10%. And from these, we saw really, really sharp reactions in both your copper market and in your coffee market, because Brazil is such a large supplier of coffee beans. So to me, that kind of signals that at a micro level, when there's very specific targeted announcements around tariffs, we are seeing a market reaction. But at a large scale, when we think about all of the trade negotiations that are ongoing, the market seems to be a bit more complacent and of the feeling of this will work out.
Well, can I put it to you then? that is there a chance that in the White House, Trump and his team says, OK, everything you've said has happened, which is the markets have recovered, volatility has dropped. In terms of economic data, whether it's economic growth or inflation, the impact of tariffs haven't really come through. So instead of a taco trade, the Trump always chickens out trade, are we actually looking at a situation where they say, you know what, let's drive this home because the market can handle it? Are we at risk of that?
Potentially. I it's so hard to read what's happening at the moment and anticipate what can come forward. Uncertainty is the number one word. Mm-hmm. We're sick of saying it. And it is the thing that's creating the largest cost at the moment. They could potentially go down that route. But I think we're entering into an interesting period at the moment as well. Remember, we're now...
We're only entering it into. Jeez,
well,
Kate.
When I talk about when we're now entering into Q2 earnings season.
Yes, yes.
So that may produce some interesting movements across the market because, frankly, in reality, and you're an economist, you know this too, much of our data up to this point is lagging.
Yes.
So the markets haven't really seen any large-scale impact to economies from the tariffs that have been announced to date. Once we begin to get some of those earning readings, what will be watched on is their future outlooks, their future predictions, how they are reading their markets going forward. If they have a negative lens on them, we may see some form of reaction in markets. But I think it's also, and I'm guilty of this myself, I'd put my hands up, that at the moment all expectations are that really a baseline, a best outcome is a tariff baseline of 10%. And that feels okay in the environment we're in. But yet, if we were talking about 10% back in January, I would have balked at that. I would have been really, really shocked and surprised. So is it almost that to some degree markets have reacted or adjusted a little bit going, you know what, 10% is fine, we can handle it. But I think I'm more curious to go, well, markets say one thing, but on the ground, really, how do businesses, both at home and abroad, react and feel to it? 10% is large for an SME if they're directly exposed to it. So there's still huge uncertainty and fallout that's going to happen here, even if stock markets are not at the moment showing it.
Well, as you say, the data that comes out in earnings is either real because it has passed and mm-hmm. it is earnings season, of course, is when companies have to report on their earnings or their profits. And if they've had to swallow that 10% or more, or also, of course, we have the impact of the weakening dollar. There's a range of things certainly to look out at. But if we could go back to being on the ground, right? Mm-hmm. And I want to pick up on the letters that went out this week. And I want to take the drama out of one headline because Japan and South Korea were both threatened this week with 25% tariffs. These two countries are the biggest trading partners after Canada, Mexico and the EU. And it sounded really significant. But if you account for the nuance around autos, electronics and pharma, if he was to really follow through with that, the overall effective tariff rate on US imports would rise from 15.5% to 16.6%. So the letters this week, was it much ado about nothing?
It's a good question. I think... Potentially, would people in those economies say that? Potentially not also. Mm-hmm. There's so much noise out there at the moment. And we really saw that post April 2nd as well. And it's back to that, you know, put taco trades to the side or how optimistic or pessimistic someone is. We can't get away from the fact that this is a fundamental shift in global trade policy. And at the end of all this, when resolutions are found, and they will be found, hopefully, even though there's still an uncertainty around that, we're still left with a situation where tariffs will be much higher than what they have been for over 100 years. And also potentially the dollar in a very different position than what it has been in more recent times. And they're almost the sticky effects of all the noise that has been there. And they will have a really large impact on how economies perform, how businesses react. So it's trying to put aside some of the noise that are the headlines there, as you rightly said, that on a numbers basis actually don't really mean much, and go to, well, what are the more long-term sticky effects of this? And it is that tariffs will be higher than what they were at the start of this year. And that dynamic of the dollar versus the euro. And for me, actually, the stock market aside, the movement in currencies has been the most fascinating story of all this.
And sticky, as you say.
And sticky. Even though stock markets recovered, currencies didn't. So the euro still appreciated against the dollar. We saw a little bit of a pullback in more recent days, but it's still sitting at $1.17. And that is a fundamental change. It's up over 12%. It hasn't budged. And does that signal that even though markets are kind of ignoring it, they're seeing it as noise, that deep down underneath, they still recognise as well that this is a fundamental shift. There is concerns over the strength of the US economy and also potentially how they deal with their ever-growing government debt that's there as well. And how much further can that go in the coming few months? And it raises questions both in US and in European terms. We've battled inflation for the past few years, and now you're beginning to read headlines of the ECB is wondering, will we see disinflation here because of the strength of that euro? That's a phenomenal change. And also for our exporters, it creates a very different environment for them as well, importing into the US. Our goods are now more expensive to a US consumer.
I was only saying to listeners earlier on in the show, I was there during the week, I was in the US, and the difference in my purchasing power as a result of a stronger euro was really, really striking. But I want to come back to something you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation today, which is particularly around Brazil and copper. And I want to ask you, Kate, what do you think these tariffs are really all about? Because in the case of Brazil, Trump said the country wasn't good to the US, but the US has sold $650 million more to Brazil in the first 3 months of the year than they bought from him. And of course, he obviously has his political allegiance as well. And in the case of copper, like, the country doesn't have enough refining capacity or smelters. But yet, as you said, he wants to introduce a potential 50% tariff on the commodity. So is Trump simply using the might of the US economy to do or pick a fight wherever he wants?
I can never get in the mind of
take it and join the queue.
Yeah. Donald Trump. Unfortunately, as an economist, that definitely goes outside my skill set, and I look more back to the data. And as you said, from a trade perspective, Brazil isn't necessarily a threat from a US perspective. But I think some of this comes back to, and it's all back to, what started this? It started it from a shift to a very different mindset towards America first. And it also resolves around security. We've heard very many times, and looking at certain minerals or materials or core components of products that were seen as essential to having within the United States in order for them, almost in some respect, to be self-efficient. Now, does the implication or the proposal of these tariffs, does that actually help that when the country doesn't have the capacity to supply the copper levels they require? And remember, copper goes into so many different parts of the economy, from electronics to construction to industrial equipment. But it is that America first policy that they're trying to attack here. Does it work? We don't know.
Well, as we come to the end of our conversation today, it's important that I do bring our chat close to home, because we have gone around the world as we land back here. The two big issues of the week is the EU-US trade deal and, of course, the potential 200% 18-month tariff on pharma. Now, if we take the latter first, 70,000 people employed in high-skilled jobs in the sector, 40% of exports from the pharma sector go to the US. Is there anything Ireland can do politically, diplomatically, economically to prevent a really big problem with this? Or, again, is it something else that could be just pushed down the road?
I think the pharmaceutical one from day one has been where our biggest fear has been within Ireland. As you rightly stated, they account for a really large share of our exports when it comes to value. That conversation dissipated a little bit post April 2nd when they were exempt from it, and we began to look at other industries that were more exposed, for example, spirits, where it became very evident, even though they only accounted for 3% of our exports, over 45% of all spirits that left the island of Ireland went to the United States. But now that has come back around again to pharmaceuticals, as we know there are investigations undergoing to that particular sector. From an Irish perspective, it's really hard to see what we can do from that front. Some of that does play into negotiations that are ongoing between the US and the EU. And that comes back to Ireland making sure their voice is heard loud enough in those EU conversations as well. And many other countries will be doing the same for those sectors that they are most exposed to. Germany in the automobile industry, for example. There is an element with pharmaceuticals that it's very, very tricky to try and impose such a large scale shift on maybe how it is produced, manufactured, shipped, because it's a life dependent good.
And costly and time intensive and everything.
Markets at the moment are reading at this 200% increase in tariff. It won't follow through. There's a huge amount of time employed. I think it's a year and a half before anything will come into effect from it. And even at that, it was a bit blurry as to what would happen next. So Irish Eyes will still be very wary of it. Any pharmaceutical firms here will still be doing their scenario analysis. But does it lead to large scale shifts in the morning? I don't believe it does.
Irish Eyes will be watching it. The question is whether they'll be smiling. Oh, Kate, I had so much more to talk to you about, including transshipment and all sorts of things, but we're right up against the clock. Thanks so much indeed for joining me. Kate English, Chief Economist at Deloitte.
Thank you.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at Ireland's Sovereign Wealth Fund. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton, and I want to thank everybody who responded to the piece we did with carers last week. Val and David were talking about it on X, and I want to particularly read out a comment that Jacqueline had on LinkedIn. She said, "I've had the personal challenges and needed to do both carers leave and carers allowance over different periods of time. And honestly, it's extremely difficult as a woman in the business world. Trying to show your child that there is a way through it all and keeping up in the workforce is so worth it. But I wish I could have done more to support my health during those days too. Physically, mentally and emotionally, I was burnt out." And Jacqueline, thanks so much indeed for sharing that with me and our listeners here today. Now, Ireland's ambitious plans to build a 100 billion euro sovereign wealth fund are in question as falling budget surplus projections raise serious concerns. I'm joined now by Daniel Murray, policy editor with the Business Post, who's been reporting on what's driving this shift and what it means for the future of Ireland's public finances. So first of all, Daniel, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thanks very much for having me on, Susan.
Well, we'll start off, first of all, to look at why is it that Ireland set up a sovereign wealth fund in the first place? And we needed to put some of the money away that was being generated by exceptional corporate taxes to both prepare for climate change and an ageing, growing population. So specifically, there was going to be a 4 billion euro annual transfer to the Future Ireland Fund and a 2 billion annual transfer to the Infrastructure, Climate and Nature Fund. So what's happening, Daniel?
Yeah, so as you say, because of the boom really in corporate tax receipts over recent years driven by multinationals, the government had started running fairly large surpluses, but the forecast surpluses for the years ahead were even bigger. So, for example, back in 2023, it was predicted that by 2026, surpluses could rise to as much as 20.8 billion. And a surplus is basically when the government takes in more tax than it spends in the year, so it has money left over. So, as you say, they decided, OK, we need to find somewhere to park some of this excess money. And the best place to park that would be in these sovereign wealth funds. And they went to set up two. One of them, the Future Ireland Fund, to try and deal with basically future demographic pressures from an ageing population and pressures around pension costs and health system costs. And then separately, the Infrastructure, Climate and Nature Fund, which was to deal basically with kind of capital funding when there's a downturn in the economy, that there's some kind of a backstop there. The bigger one was the Future Ireland Fund. It was to build up to about 100 billion by 2035. And then the smaller one being the Infrastructure Fund, which the intention was to build up to 14 billion by at the end of this decade. But of course, to be able to do that, you have to have the surpluses in the first place to be able to transfer into them. And that's something that, because of the changing geopolitical situation, those surpluses may not be there into the future, though it is still a very uncertain situation. I mean, just take, for example, back in 2023, as I said, it was predicted that we would have a surplus in 2026 of 20.8 billion. Last year, that was revised down to 8.3 billion. Then of May of this year, that was revised down to 6.3 billion. And now, because of the potential of new baseline tariffs from the United States and Donald Trump, Pascal Donohue has admitted that budget surpluses may have to be revised down yet again. And when you start falling below that 6 billion mark, clearly you don't have the necessary money to transfer into those two funds on a yearly basis. And either you have to transfer less in, or you cut spending or raise taxes or borrow money to fund those transfers. So posing some fairly significant questions for the government there if those things come to pass.
OK, now, everything you're saying there, particularly when we start off with the 20 billion surplus all the way down to the alternative economic scenario that you wrote about in your piece last weekend, where you were saying that the budget surplus could fall as low as 3.4 billion in 2026. But I want to put another number to you. The Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, Daniel, reported earlier in the year that the government is running a surplus. Every single one of those numbers you mentioned are still surpluses. But if you took out the excess corporation tax receipts and the recent economic buoyancy, there is actually a structural deficit equivalent to €2,500 per worker. Therefore, have the finances of the country been run into this vulnerability?
I think it's very true that we've kind of been running the public finances on a credit card, and that credit card is the corporate tax receipts that have boomed to unnatural levels in recent years. They've really grown to a level that internationally is seen as exceptional, and that our own Department of Finance and Minister for Finance accept are abnormal and possibly could disappear in the future. And as you signaled there, the Department of Finance has identified about half of those corporate tax receipts, which are in and around 30 billion, to be windfall in nature, meaning they could possibly disappear at any point in time. So in some ways, actually, what we're seeing, we've been talking for a long time about windfall corporate taxes possibly disappearing into the future and us moving from budget surplus into budget deficit. But actually what we're seeing happening in real time in terms of these revision down of forecasts is some of that actually coming to fruition. When you move from a forecast a couple of years ago of a surplus of 20 billion, and now we're looking at possibly that falling down as low as 3.5 billion this year, depending what happens in terms of trade deals between the EU and US, we're seeing quite a dramatic change in picture for the public finances. And part of that comes down to the reliability and our reliance on those exceptional corporate tax receipts.
Well, when I think of your analogy there about running the public finances on a credit card, the only thing is the money is real. We don't have to give it back. As you say, there might be a chance of it going away, but at least we have it. And what's in there is there. But I would like to just ask you to add some nuance to the conversation around corporation tax. Because, of course, all week this week we've been talking about tariffs. Earlier on in the show, we were doing the same. But, Daniel, currently, corporation tax, it's our second biggest tax head after income tax, and 75% of it is dependent on US companies. So what nuanced view do you have on the role that US trade policy, particularly the potential imposition of tariffs, is playing in undermining Ireland's corporate tax base? Because that 200% tariff figure this week, potentially on farmers, seemed to come off the top of Trump's head. Like, really and truly, what do you think is likely to happen to that corporation tax base?
It's very hard to know because there are different scenarios. One is a more acute scenario about what happens in the coming weeks with regards to a trade deal between the US and the EU. And we have a scenario where there's, the best case scenario where there's a trade deal reached and there's zero for zero tariffs on a range of sectors, especially strategic sectors for Ireland, like the pharmaceutical sector. And that could be a much more positive situation for Ireland, where the impact on corporate taxes and on the wider public finances is more minimal. You could have a scenario where there's a 10% baseline tariff, which is kind of what the government is now baking in and is expecting is going to be the case, except for individual carve-outs for sectors. And that could have a significant impact on the public finances, as I say, even bringing budget surpluses down as low as 3.5 billion. Or you could have the worst case scenario where you talked there about just in the last week, Donald Trump threatening 200% tariffs on the pharmaceutical sector, a sector that is of extreme importance to Ireland's economy and of extreme importance to those booming corporate tax receipts that we talk about. And if that level of tariff was imposed on Ireland in the short term, it'd be a very acute shock to the system. Or if, as Donald Trump seems to have suggested, the threat of that tariff is put on the long finger, so a 200% tariff is threatened to come in a year or 2 years' time, with the incentive meant to be to get farmer firms to reshore their operations over to the US, you possibly could see a slow drip of FDI moving offshore in Ireland, although it is very difficult to move big pharmaceutical operations. So you can see the range of scenarios at play there. And really that, I think, is the story as we face into budget 2026 for the finance ministers, Pascal Donoghue and Jack Chambers. they are just faced with a range of different, drastically different scenarios, making it almost impossible to plan for budget 2026 and for spending in the next 4 to 5 years, which they have to actually submit to the European Commission as well. So it is a level of uncertainty, I think, that is really driving so much of the trouble for government at the moment.
But Daniel, I think you're right that the story here isn't just what tariffs would be imposed, but what the expectation is and the actions taken as a result of those expectations, which of course are responses to the threats that are put there as well. Can I go back to something you mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation today? And that is the scenario where there isn't enough of a surplus to go into the fund and therefore there might be alternatives. And like one of them, as you say, is to borrow, like to borrow money today and pay interest on it, to put money into a sovereign wealth fund so that it can accumulate to pay the expense of tomorrow seems counterintuitive. But the reality is that both of the sovereign wealth funds have been legislated for. And therefore, if budget surpluses falls to the level projected in the Department of Finance's alternative scenario, or of course, we also don't know what's going to happen between now and then. What are the political or economic implications of failing to meet the statutory commitments to these funds?
So in the legislation, last year's legislation for both the Future Ireland Fund and for the Infrastructure, Climate and Nature Fund, it does provide for a scenario whereby the economic conditions change and there are less surpluses or even in some circumstances a deficit and the money isn't available to put into the funds anymore. And basically the process there is that the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, which is the government's kind of fiscal watchdog, it does an assessment by September, and it'll do this assessment this year by September, to say whether or not the funds are there to be able to transfer in. And if they aren't, it can make a recommendation about transferring less in, and there are provisions within the legislation which can say about half the amount can be transferred in or none of it can be transferred in if that's required as well. So there is a release valve there, but you know that raises more serious, wider questions about if we can't capitalise the funds, especially the Future Ireland Fund, to the 100 billion that was intended by 2035, which of course is meant to provide necessary and urgent funding for huge demographic changes coming down the track.
The costs haven't
Ireland.
Gone away from the future, have they? Independent
they
of the surpluses
so
today.
What's the plan B is the question that gets raised there. It's not an immediate acute crisis where we would still be talking about having surpluses in the public finances, which is a very healthy place to be. But suddenly we might be faced much more quickly than we had assumed with the question of what do we do if we can't capitalise these funds to the level we wanted and what the alternative is.
And this is the thing, is that what will you and I be talking about in 10 years or in 15 years time and dating back to or harping back to our conversation today about the decisions taken. But before I delve any more into the Irish picture, I do want to take a trip around the world with you, please, because if we were to look for role models when it comes to sovereign wealth funds, what do you see? Like, is it Chile's ESSF, a sovereign wealth fund that was created in 2007 to manage the country's copper revenues, of all things to talk about this week, and shield the economy from commodity volatility? Or is it Saudi Arabia with its high-profile global investments to leverage wealth for influence? Is it Alaska? Is it Norway? Like, who are we modelling on?
Well, I think the one that's always kind of held up as the model is Norway. Mm. We've got exceptional money from their oil and gas fields that they began to put into sovereign wealth funds and invest. And it has allowed them to do all kinds of things as a society, including being able to drive the energy transition, which is a very cost intensive process. But they've been able to do things like subsidize the electrification of transport to a level that other countries haven't. So certainly I think they were the kind of model that the government was looking at when they were looking at setting up this Future Ireland Fund. But in some ways it was a bit different as well, because it wasn't just that they were looking to set up a sovereign wealth fund to have money in the future come what may. It was almost setting up the sovereign wealth fund because it was known that there was going to be these extremely large costs to do with demographic changes. And these are things like rising pension costs, rising healthcare costs from an aging population. And of course, the fact that not only will we have an aging population, but actually the ratio of younger workers to older people is going to change drastically as well, meaning a proportionately smaller workers' tax base to fund those growing spending needs. So the spending demand was almost already there in the first place, which made it slightly different. And this was seen as a solution to that. But there was always criticism of it as a solution. I mean, it was welcomed to be responsible with this level of surplus and try park some of it. But actually, if you have permanent demographic changes coming down the tracks, really that needs to be funded by permanent changes to the public finances and to the tax base. And that has been something that to date, I don't think that the government has been willing to tackle.
OK, and that's where I want to go next, because we are dealing with an ageing population. There's been gorgeous weather here during the week, and it's likely that we will have climate-related immigration. And we're also having a growing population, right? So let's take ageing, climate, immigration, and also a growing population. Take all of that into consideration. What is your sense of how the government is feeling now about planning for the budget? They've had years of surpluses and giveaway budgets to use to their economic and political and demographic planning advantage. And I know you were saying there that the government hasn't wanted to tackle this, but this is real. So what does it do now, do you think?
In some ways, the budget, it's such a shorter cycle. It's a single year thing, and they're still going to have surpluses running into this budget, though they may be revised down. So it doesn't have too much of an impact in a more immediate sense. But in that longer term, it does raise questions about the ability to be able to fund these things. And it is a question really of the tax base and the position of the tax base. And we spoke about corporate taxes earlier and how much they have grown as a proportion of the tax base. And the Fiscal Advisory Council just last year highlighted how Ireland's underlying tax revenue, so that's when you exclude windfall corporate tax receipts, that they were actually at their lowest share of the economy since 1980 and continuing to narrow rapidly. And the Department of Finance actually warned Pascal Donoghue as he was coming back into that office earlier this year that the tax base is now extremely narrow and represents a serious vulnerability to the public finances. And those same officials had warned before that while the Future Ireland Fund was a good addition to the public finances in terms of trying to fund some of those future demographic pressures, it wouldn't be enough. And that was even before there were questions over whether it would be capitalized fully. So broadening the tax base ultimately becomes the question here, unless you're going to talk about massively cutting spending. And just earlier this year, the OECD and the Commission, and a couple of years ago, the Commission for Taxation and Welfare, they recommended looking at things like reforming the personal income tax base and even looking at the number of reduced VAT rates that there are across the economy and bringing some of those up. So there's some of the solutions. There's also been proposals from the European Commission to unwind a massive fossil fuel subsidies that there are in this country. The state pays about $4.9 billion every year subsidizing fossil fuels in different ways. So these are all the kinds of avenues that probably need to be explored. But as we know in this country, when you begin to talk about raising taxes,
they're nettles. I mean, any one of what you've said there are very significant nettles to grasp. And I'm sure we'll be talking about that in the weeks and months to come. Daniel Murray, policy editor with the Business Post, thank you so much indeed for joining me today to talk about a really important topic.
Thank you, Susan.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at a new book all around the rise and fall of the modern CEO. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and I want to share some excerpts of a very thoughtful email we received about DEI, diversity, equity and inclusion, after the conversation I had recently with Daniel Thomas from the Financial Times. So this listener says, companies have not abandoned DEI in their publicity. I still see lots of ads with people of colour, older people, wheelchair users, lesbian and gay couples. Does being black, disabled or gay not count as DEI anymore? Are progress flags and a drag queen or two necessary for it to be proper DEI? Diversity is a big word. It contains multitudes. And if it doesn't include people with disabilities, women, lesbian and gays, older people, people with mental health issues, etc., etc., on an equal footing, it's not promoting true equality. Hopefully DEI will spread its wings again and return to the core values that define it. So thanks so much indeed to that listener for taking the time to pen a longer email than that. But I did want to share the essence of it with you today. So what makes a good CEO? And does the question matter to the general public? Well, my next two guests think CEOs, and particularly across the water to our nearest neighbour, do indeed play a very important role in society. So their new book, CEO, The Rise and Fall of Britain's Captains of Industry, provides an overview of how the role of the CEO has evolved since the 19th century. So it's great to welcome Dr. Michael Aldous and Professor John Turner, both from Queen's University, to the show. So, gentlemen, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thanks very much.
Well, first of all, I'll start with you, Dr. Michael. As I boarded my 7-hour Aer Lingus flight from Cleveland Airport on Tuesday night to Dublin, I started reading the book. and I found it gripping. And by the time the tea had come around, I was well into the second chapter. But one of the first things that struck me was how managing a big business is actually a relatively new thing. Like you mentioned, the first company to have revenues of $1 billion was the US United States Steel Corporation in the early 1900s. And today, one third of all business activity in the OECD is undertaken by companies with revenues over $1 billion. So, Michael, how has the role of the CEO changed over the past 150 years?
That's a great question, Susan. And you're absolutely right that one of the key issues and one of the key changes has been the size of the businesses. They've got significantly larger across the 20th century. If we think about simply the number of people employed, the geographic spread of them, then the complexities of the types of business that they're involved in, we've seen, you know, a significant increase in the size and scope. And because of that, we've then had to see a change in the role of those running the companies. At the beginning of the century, what we would see as a very normal setup was, for example, a chairman who made the sort of strategic decisions on behalf of the shareholders, and then a managing director who ran the company on a day-to-day basis. But over the century, what we find has been this sort of consolidation of the role within a single, all-powerful executive, described as the chief executive officer or the CEO. So across the century and by the 1980s, this becomes the predominant way in which large companies are run, with this single all-powerful CEO in charge. And of course, behind that then has been the, you know, empowering of these individuals. They've become more powerful and more consequential in the businesses, making the decisions both strategic and on a day-to-day basis. So we think that's one of the most significant changes that we see across the century.
And John, can I go to you next, please? Because as we've just heard there, when you think about the size, the scope, the complexity, all of those things, you're still talking about an individual needing to manage that. And the second thread of the book focuses on how training and career experience is developed. And I found that very interesting. But I particularly want to ask you a little bit of a tangential question, because several times in the book, you pick up on the personal cost of having to manage this. And particularly, you talk about Victor Spencer, for example, and you said at one stage, his wife took his children, he never saw them again. And to quote, you said, "The personal price paid to occupy high profile and demanding roles was sometimes extreme." So, John, can I ask you, can CEOs be trained to manage the personal cost?
Oh, that's an excellent question, because, yeah, as you point out in the book, we do highlight there are a few CEOs who did pay a high personal cost, whether it be their family life or their own health. I suppose the ability to walk away after an 18-hour day and switch off, and the ability to take, you know, one day off in the weekend or whatever and switch off, that's something I think that for some people comes naturally, but for others, you need to train them to be able to switch off and to have that. But very few CEOs are of that nature. They are kind of people who are always on. And so the people with that type of that personality type tend to select into the role, Susan.
But it was also the high profile nature of it as well, John, that struck me. Is the sometimes you talk about the celebrity CEO, the person who liked to occupy some space on the front page, etc. So it's not just about their ability to work in the business, but also to be the face of the business to sometimes tens of millions of people.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's actually the most famous example of this was a guy called Thomas Lipton. Mm-hmm. Who we have Lipton teas today. To, you know, he's really the person behind that. His parents emigrated from Ireland just after the famine to Glasgow. And Lipton was famous for glad handing, and he owned several yachts, and he would entertain royalty and celebrities on his yachts during his holidays. And he saw this as part of raising the brand and his image and the image of his company. So his personal life and that sort of celebrity life was all part and parcel of him raising the profile of his business. And he loved appearing on the front pages of newspapers and the tittle-tattle. And he loved that because it was raising the Lipton brand.
Well, you're both very talented at narrative and storytelling, I have to say. I really felt like I was getting to know these guys. I thought he really quite enjoyed it, actually, myself, too, as I was reading about him. Dr. Michael, can I go back to you? As you move through the decades in the book, you talk about social mobility and diversity of CEOs. And of course, being a female CEO myself, I have to bring this up. I'll just first of all quote something you said. You said gender diversity was much slower in taking root, although we show how women played important roles in corporations over the century. And in 1920, 40.1% of Great Western Railway's shareholders were women, but social norms didn't see the boardroom as a fit place for women. So they were okay to invest in companies, but simply not run them. What were the pivot points for women entering the boardroom over the years?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting aspect of the book. And we don't see a female CEO with that designation until 1997. And that's Marjorie Scardino, who became the CEO of Pearson. The next CEO is Cynthia Carroll, who was CEO of Anglo American from 2007. So this is a very long time until we actually see women move into the boardroom. And so we try and track why this was the case, because if you go back to that period, the 1920s and 30s, these social norms were very much against women occupying these roles, despite the fact there were real pathbreakers at the time. A woman called Margaret Hay Thomas, Vice Countess of Rhondda. She was on the board of 33 companies. She was the chairman of seven. She was the first female president of the Institute of Directors in 1926. She founded this thing called the Efficiency Club, which promoted women's role in business. So why didn't she break a pathway for more women into the boardroom? So we partially think this is a question of legislation, and that gender discrimination legislation didn't really come into play until the 1970s in the UK. And that was a major issue. It changed a decade earlier in the US, hence why we think, you know, Marjorie Scardino and Cynthia Carroll were both American. And that they had simply had more time to prepare women, and the social norms had changed much earlier in America. It's taken a long time, far too much time. But if we see over the last 10 years, there has been quite significant changes, particularly in boardrooms. If you look in 2025, there's now 44% of directors in the FTSE 100 are women. And this will change, and it will continue to change. There's now 9 women CEOs in the FTSE 100. The thing to remember here, though, is it takes about 30 years to prepare somebody for this role in terms of education and career experience. So building these pipelines takes time. But we now think that you will begin over the next decade, there will be sort of a continued increase in the number of women CEOs in the FTSE 100.
It's interesting how you say it takes 30 years, because in the chapter where you talk about the development of the CEO, there wasn't always that time, particularly if they grew up in the family business, until, of course, there was the professional CEO. But John, I'd like to pick up on a point that Michael made there about the first two female CEOs of FTSE 100 companies were American. And the reason I want to do that is over and over and over in the book, you constantly refer to what's going on in the US, whether it was that. And in fact, the first three women, as you mentioned, were American of FTSE 100 listed companies. Also, how business schools began in America before in the UK. And of course, the risk-taking culture. Like, what is it about a US CEO that differentiates them?
Yeah, so you're right. In the book, we have the US almost like a benchmark.
Because that's a better way of putting it, actually, yeah.
Yeah. So in the 20th century, they were the best run firms in the world. They were the most productive firms in the world and the most successful firms in the world. Part of that's to do with the fact that they became an economic powerhouse. Part of that is to do with the size of their market. But they just were better run firms. And it's really interesting, after the Second World War, a lot of American investment capital comes to Europe, but they also bring in management expertise. And so there's a lot of training of managers in Italian companies, German companies, French companies, because the US had a mindset of training and preparing managers. As you said, the MBA is essentially invented in the United States in 1908 with the Harvard MBA. You've got the Wharton Business School setting up in the early 1880s. They are just so far ahead of the game in terms of preparing people for the top job. And when, we look at, so one of the companies we look at in the book is called the British Motor Corporation. It's the company that gave us the Mini. And it was really badly run. And we compare it to General Motors in the United States, or even Ford in the United States. And these companies were just so much better run. And that really came from the top and the way that those companies prepared their CEO and their top managers.
But Michael, it didn't seem to be the focus was solely on the companies being better run in a geography. I felt that there was an overall theme in the book of well, as well, of a criticism of UK productivity as a whole. And of course, certainly economists talk about that as why is productivity in the UK so low? But it just seemed to be that there was almost like the CEOs were synonymous for how they led productivity in line with macroeconomic performance. Was my reading of that right?
So yes, in part, we're trying to find a way in which we can understand the impact of CEOs, not just on the firms that they manage, but on the wider economy. And we think productivity is a good benchmark for us to think about this, because productivity really is the transformation of inputs into a firm to outputs. So how effective are they at using labor, using capital? How effective are they at utilizing new technologies, innovating? All of these are encapsulated within productivity. And so we use that as a way of trying to understand how effective they are within their own companies, but also in a more sort of macro way within the British economy. And what we do see is that there is a significant divergence across the century around Britain's productivity performance. So we do see it, certainly fall behind the US quite early in the century. But even after the war, then this gradual sort of fall behind in terms of the big industrial powers in Europe, Germany and France. So why has this divergence happened? And we think there is a significant role played in that by the quality of Britain's corporate leadership. And as John alluded to, and you both alluded to earlier, you know, the lack of sort of training, the lack of formalized development, they simply weren't as well developed as their contemporaries in the US, in France, in Germany. And this leads into this productivity decline in the UK. So we think part of rethinking productivity does require us now to sort of think about the quality of corporate leadership. Who's getting to the top? How are they trained? How are they prepared? And to ensure that they really can positively influence productivity outcomes.
But Michael, the sheer amount of responsibility that sits on these people's desk in line with whole economies, like you mentioned, in the year Martin Sorrell stepped down, WPP was responsible for 1% of the UK's overall tax take. So I thought that was one of the most enjoyable aspects of the book, actually, was not just looking at the story of the business or strategy or various things like that, but actually looking at the connection between the company, the tax take, the economy, the lot. John, I'm going to go to you for my last question, because the book says that CEOs need to be on top of demography, social and economic trends, consumer behaviour, global macro trends, the political landscape and new technology. Now, for a start, every CEO in the world should be listening to this show anyway. But after all of your experience of researching and writing this book, what makes a good CEO today?
So in our book, we've got 1,400 CEOs. And we've got four traits that mark out the great CEOs in the book. So first of all, they're smart, as your question alludes to. These individuals are smart. Doesn't mean they're university educated. It just means they're smart. They've got this cognitive ability to understand the world they're living in. And they need that because they're trying to take their company from this year out into the future, 5 years time, grow it and develop it. And that requires them to develop a strategy. And that needs a lot of smarts. Second thing then is if you're going to have a strategy and you're going to implement the strategy, we find that great CEOs are super organized, they're diligent, and they've got attention to detail. These are not just great thinkers, but they're also great details individuals, and they're able to then implement their strategy. And the third thing, if you want to grow your company and develop your company, you need people to do that. And so the great CEOs, the very best CEOs, have superb interpersonal skills. They know how to work with people, build teams, and get the best out of people. And I think the final trait that we've noticed about great CEOs is that they're not necessarily driven by profits, by money, by the share price. They're driven by some sort of personal purpose. And one of the best examples of this in the book is a guy called William Lever, where we get the company Unilever from. And his whole drive was to provide cleanliness to poor people. Because he was manufacturing soap. That was what was driving him. That was his personal purpose. And so happened, he made a lot of money doing that. But the best CEOs are driven by that sort of wider societal purpose.
And John,
the four things.
John, you know what was one of the saddest lines I found in the book was about Thomas Sutherland, where you said his autocratic style had inhibited the rise of the next Sutherland. And it was a really pithy line that stood out to me. I could talk to you both for a lot longer. It really is. It's a super read. Congratulations to you both, Dr. Michael Aldous and Professor John Turner, both from Queen's University. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you, Susan.
Well, that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes-Culloden. I hope you enjoyed the show and picked up something new about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go for your podcasts. And please do subscribe to the show while you're there. Taking Stock is on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. here on News Talk. And the producer of the show is John Fardy. And on research this week was Stephen Daunt. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. And I look forward to chatting to you again next week.